Welcome to Sibylline Podcasts, part of our World Risk Register Threat Monitoring Service. These podcasts are released on a weekly basis, covering timely and relevant topics. In these discussions, we hope to shed light on evolving scenarios and provide actionable predictions and implications. We hope you enjoy listening and welcome any feedback.
Hello and welcome to the Sibylline podcast. I'm Justin Crump, CEO of Sibylline, and today we're going to talk about the situation in Nicaragua, which has been boiling over since the 18th of April. This is related to reforms to the National Social Security Institute, or the INSS, which have sparked widespread rioting and protests, particularly over the weekend of 21st, 22nd of April. 25 people were killed during the rioting, and one of them, a journalist, was actually killed while broadcasting on Facebook Live in a very dramatic incident. Although the protests started over a single issue, they rapidly widened and were particularly embraced by the student movement. Overall, this has formed quite a challenge to the perception of the president's ability to control the country, and on the 23rd of April, the US government took the step of ordering the evacuation of families, something that obviously caused great concern amongst the private sector as well in the country. So this is an issue we've been following with some interest, of course, over the last week. And joining me today is Antonio Scheinborn. So, Ant, welcome. And being one of our Latin American analysts, he's been following this in some detail. So Ant, I mean, how are you seeing the situation? How has it developed? You know, what are the key issues currently at play in Nicaragua?
Well, the key thing that's emerged from these protests is that they have exposed cracks, significant cracks in the perception that President Ortega's government has full control over the country. Mm-hmm. Even though he's decided to repeal the, well, that's evidenced by his decision to repeal the decree.
Yeah.
Now, that coupled with the willingness and eagerness in which protesters took to the streets and knocked down symbols of his government marked a significant moment in a country where people are often told and have the perception that the government has complete control of the country.
Mm-hmm. This isn't the first time that Nicaragua has seen this sort of interest, I think, related to the pension funds. I mean, as far as I understand it, it's to do with, obviously, financial mismanagement for the majority of what the protesters are saying. But can you explain more of the background around that?
That's right. So Nicaragua's National Social Security Institute are in a financial crisis. And that's why President Ortega has brought in these reforms. What the reforms essentially do is demand an increase in contributions from workers and a reduction in payouts to retirees.
Right.
Now, that kind of scenario, as you'd imagine, would not sit well with the Nicaraguan public.
Yes.
However, what amplifies this is that successive governments in Nicaragua have been accused of using the INSS as a source of cash throw.
Right.
So this has fostered over some time an anti-government sentiment amongst much of the population, claiming that now it's workers and pensioners that are being forced to contribute to make up for the state's mismanagement of funds.
Right. So, I mean, it seems, I mean, something we noticed that this wasn't one group, there wasn't a sort of political particular group that was driving protests. It was kind of a broad, I wouldn't even say coalition of people, a broad range of people that were taking part in events, and obviously the students most dramatically, particularly following some of the initial deaths that were reported. So, I mean, does that reflect the fact this is widespread anger in society in Nicaragua?
Yeah, that's completely right, Justin. And this is something that we're seeing that's characterizing the protests is that they're largely leaderless. Mm. They haven't been organized by a major political party or a particular organization. Their leaders, many of them are university students, pensioners, people who've convinced their peers and members of their local communities to stand up to the government. And it's this leaderless nature of the wider national protest. We can view this as both in terms of the demonstrations achieving their goals, if you like, we can view this as both a strength and a weakness.
Right.
It's a strength in that Ortega and his government can't simply restrict the protests by arresting two or three figureheads. However, the other side to that is that the protesters, there's no real plan or idea as to who would replace Ortega if these protests see his removal from office.
Hmm.
Now, we know that a clear alternative vision for a leader is not necessarily a requirement for protests, but the crucial takeaway from this is that lack of direction, if that continues to be the case, will shape the post-protest environment
right.
And will ultimately determine whether these anti-government demonstrations succeed beyond simply Ortega deciding to withdraw the proposed changes to the social security system.
Right. I mean, one hesitates. It's almost overdone to constantly draw comparisons to the Arab Spring, but I can see some small comparison here where, right. You know, one thing touched on a widespread vein of dissent that was existing in the country. But I mean, to what extent was this something that could be anticipated?
It certainly could have been. We had a similar incident in 2013 where protests over social security reforms caused a very similar response, and that we had a heavy-handed response from Nicaragua's security forces, particularly members of the Sandinista Youth, who are a younger group of government supporters. They were actually filmed violently confronting peaceful protests on the Masaya Highway. And these, we can see these, how both in 2013 and this year, it underscores Ortega's willingness for the government to implement heavy-handed methods to combat dissent. Right. And that is ultimately why we've seen a continuation of the protests, even after Ortega made the decision to withdraw the changes to the pension system.
Yeah.
It's that ongoing willingness to respond to any form of public dissent with such brutality. That is the main driver of why they've continued. Not only that, we've seen restrictions in freedom of expression. Ortega clamped down on privately owned media companies reporting on the demonstrations throughout the country.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that has regionally caused a response from the wider community. Costa Rica were very quick to criticize Ortega's decision to block any kind of comprehensive coverage of the protests in the country.
Yeah.
And you know, Costa Rica and Nicaragua already have an ongoing border dispute, and that immediate response from San Jose is likely to further increase tensions between the two countries.
Yeah, it's interesting that wider consequence, and I think something it potentially throws up is that role of social media in these sorts of protests in this sort of environment, and again, particularly with the Facebook Live streaming of the journalists then being shot, which I think couldn't have been a more dramatic moment. And so it didn't say anything about press freedoms. And obviously a lot of people saying, well, he was deliberately shot, you know, whether it was deliberate or accident, again, I've not followed. But
I think that shows not just in Nicaragua, but this is something we're seeing worldwide. It shows the evolving nature of protests and how, you know, maybe 30, 40 years ago, the limiting coverage of them would be nipping reporting in the bud in terms of how the wider world views this. But now everyone has a phone, a camera, everyone can broadcast their own take on events. And it's that continuation of contact with, that continuation of global contact through social media that allows the support and the coverage to keep continuing. And where previously we might have seen such protests die down, it's through these advances that state repression is arguably not as effective as it might once have been.
Yeah, I mean, which is an interesting point. I think I certainly thought it was kind of conventional wisdom around the Arab Spring, and it's interesting though this year so far. I mean, having had Iran as well, which also is probably similarly leaderless, motivated by a broad basis of economic dissent, something we've seen a lot. You know, how that is manifesting in this day and age. Actually, leaderless protests say it is both that strength and a weakness. And
exactly.
I think, you know, how we're seeing it play out is exciting in these parts of the world, because, you know, sometimes it does seem to die down. And again, so what is your view in Nicaragua now? I mean, again, will repression work or not? And I know protests have carried on, but obviously at a lower level. You know, is that because the government's backed down? Is it because it's going to carry on using repression? I mean, or is it inherently going to be repressive because, as you say, the young Sandinistas are just invested in doing that?
I think ultimately we have to view these protests over social security forms as a true watershed moment between relations, in relations between the Ortega administration and the Nicaraguan society. There will now be this before and after. As mentioned, the willingness to the readiness in which Ortega was prepared to withdraw the reforms does expose cracks in his government. However, this cannot. I don't think we can overplay this. You know, fraud in Nicaragua's alleged electoral fraud in Nicaragua's electoral system in recent years has allowed Ortega to control the country's National Assembly and impose controversial changes, not least controversial constitutional changes, not least allowing him to scrap constitutional term limits, which have effectively allowed him to consolidate his power and remain in control of the country. In addition, while controlling virtually all branches of government, regulatory reforms to both the army and national police have also brought those institutions in line behind him. I think any rhetoric that Ortega is displaying at the moment, willingness to concede and foster a dialogue with protesters, it has to be taken with a pinch of salt. Ultimately, he will do these under his terms. And you know, in terms of moving forward, Ortega has not scrapped the reforms altogether. He scrapped them for the time being. He has said he's prepared to enter into a dialogue with protesters, but we have to be prepared for any future indications that the government are prepared to re-implement these initiatives will be a flashpoint for unrest in the future, particularly as the INSS is still finds itself in its own financial crisis, and reforms to the social security system are the most surefire way of easing it out of that.
Right. So fundamentally, this is something they have to tackle, and all he's doing in a way is kicking the problem down the road.
Yeah, exactly.
And the hope that things improve. And I guess, you know, more widely, what else could improve from Nicaragua? Or is it this is just delaying the inevitable, as arguably we've seen since 2013 to now?
I think it's a case of delaying the inevitable. Ortega will struggle to maintain that facade, that element of control that it was perceived that he had, and it's ultimately exposed a weakness in his regime. And the protests, as we've seen, they've had consequences beyond the country itself. Mm-hmm. Arguably, an indication that this incident is not going to be one that will stay relatively contained. The decision, it was just a few weeks after, it was actually, oddly enough, Travel and Leisure magazine called Nicaragua's Corn Island an underrated Caribbean paradise.
Right.
And fast forward 2 weeks and we have the US State Department pulling families of its embassy personnel from the country, and cruise ships were ordered to change course to avoid docking there.
Yeah.
So I think these protests will mar Nicaragua's standing in the international community, and I don't think it's something that Ortega will be able to put to bed with a more friendly rhetoric towards protesters.
You know, and that raises a more interesting point, which is where else can he turn to for help? And you and I have discussed before, obviously, the developments in Central America, and particularly the Chinese interest in Nicaragua, which we know has been somewhat growing. I mean, to what extent does this play into wider regional geopolitics?
We know that Ortega has allies with Evo Morales in Bolivia and Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. Nicaragua will not be able to enjoy the support it once had, in the financial support it once had from Venezuela, given Venezuela's own socioeconomic crisis.
Yeah.
The proposal to build the Nicaraguan canal in the country, in Nicaragua itself, that's been met with a huge anti-canal resistant movement, who themselves have stated their willingness to join the protests that we've been discussing.
Right.
And I think that's another sort of flashpoint that needs to be considered looking forward, is that if Ortega tries again to implement some kind of reform, and we have the anti-canal peasant movement joining in with that, who've declared that they are willing to travel to the capital, Managua, in solidarity with NISS protesters, this is something that I think Ortega will struggle to contain.
Right. Yeah, which I think, again, plays into that broader base that we've talked about here, of actually that being that general feeling of discontent over a number of issues. But I think what is so interesting, all the things that he can do or would like to do, and I think probably would help the country, at least financially, whether ethically, morally, or anything else, is obviously a different matter, is being met with such opposition. And that being stirred up, I think that does put him in quite a bind. So, I mean, how do you see him getting out of this?
Well, it does put Ortega in a difficult position. I mean, he's always tried to present Nicaragua as being better, if you like, than its Central American counterparts, particularly within the Northern Triangle with El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras.
Right.
And what we've seen is these demonstrations, if you could replace the name Nicaragua with Honduras, mass anti-government protests, 30 people killed. This is what we saw in Honduras last year. So I think that perception that he has tried to create of Nicaragua as being above its regional counterparts, if you like, he's going to struggle to respond from that.
Yeah. Well, and that's very interesting you mentioned that, because at the time, of course, we were very interested in the regional consequences and the more global consequences. And I guess if we think about the issues that are rampant in Central America, that might affect listeners who aren't invested in Nicaragua, but of course we're all about the systems effect, aren't we? And, you know, what is affecting us beyond that country? And, you know, I'm thinking immediately about things like smuggling, people trafficking, gangs. You know, when you mention a lot of these countries and the effects those are having across the whole region and into North America and indeed into even to Europe, how do you see that being impacted by the situation in Nicaragua and how that will develop over the next few years, given that we sort of have anticipated this is just a sign of things that will routinely come to pass and actually could even be self-fueling?
Well, as we said, it's showing that Nicaragua is not a part in terms of the issues that plague a lot of Central American countries. Electoral fraud, high-level corruption, that almost blurred line between security forces and criminal actors, whilst at the moment not as not as evident in Honduras, as we've seen as is the case in Guatemala and in Honduras. Once you cross that line between the government using state security forces to sort of quell any kind of opposition dissent, we then start to see those trends emerge between the countries in Central America.
Right. So will that drive more of these sorts of threats into, say, North America in particular? You know, will we see increased migration through the region? You know, will we see increased gang activity? Will we see increased smuggling? Or actually, does the security force response sort of mitigate against that to some extent?
The issue with US and Central American migration is an interesting one to follow up on following these demonstrations. I think we have to put the Nicaraguan demonstrations into context with the broader region. If we compare to Venezuela, the demonstrations we've seen over the last week are much in tune with what has happened in Venezuela over the last year, particularly in sort of the April to July period in 2017. But the indication we have now is that they are, for the moment, dying down. A prolonged period of such demonstrations, yes, I think Nicaraguans would be looking to get out, as many Venezuelans have, into the frontier areas of Brazil and Colombia. Given that Trump has taken such an aggressive approach towards Central American migrants, where he's removed the right to remain from many Honduran migrants, Guatemalan migrants, and those from El Salvador, I think the main concern with Central America with regards to migration is a region that's already struggling to, in terms of resources for its people, how it's going to respond to a whole influx of migrants coming from North America back into Central America. And crucially for countries like El Salvador, we know that gang activity is rife, particularly with MS-13. We have to look at the issue of remittances that are made by Central American migrants in Central America. Now, I know that 15% of El Salvador's GDP is made up by remittances. With that gap in income for many families who are then forced to return, that's the sort of thing where long-term that could see a trigger for increased gang activity as criminal groups try and step in where the state ultimately fails to provide for its citizens.
Right, so just to jump in, I mean, that's actually the much worse case, and actually to Ortega's view that, you know, come to Nicaragua, it's not as bad as the neighbours. You know, I think we've got that aspect with that, you know, it is bad in the neighbours. You know, so it's whether or not, you know, we could ever see Nicaragua, you know, declining to that level. Because, of course, these countries were not at that level once, you know. And I think particularly with San Salvador, it was natural disaster, definitely didn't help over the years. You know, and a number of those factors. To what extent are gangs actually prevalent in Nicaragua?
They are, but not to the extent that we've seen in Honduras, in other parts of Central America. I don't anticipate there being a big rise in gang activity looking to take advantage of the current volatile situation. What is far more likely is an increased spate of looting, chances for people to direct that anti-government sentiment, vandalism on government buildings, rather than a case of organized criminal activity seeking to take advantage of a sort of a slip in Ortega's control.
Right. I mean, the interesting thing in a way is that the US State Department obviously issued its advisory, withdrew families because they felt the level of general, I guess, rather than specific risk was obviously severe enough. And as you say, cruise ships being turned away. I mean, how long do we think that situation is going to persist for?
Well, I think that's just it. It was the general concern rather than a specific concern. And it goes back to that leaderless aspect that we spoke about, in that given that there is no driving force in terms of a group or an organization, it underscores that of how these demonstrations are sporadic in nature, can occur without warning. I think that is why the US State Department has taken that decision, is that it's shown that for the safety of their personnel there and their families, it's that unpredictability that is the root of the concern.
Yeah, because you just cannot anticipate when this will flash. You know, and even when it dies down, if something local could kick it off again. So I guess we're looking at this kind of persistent threat.
Yeah, and it's that sort of snowball effect. I mean, the protest started over, as we said, a relatively narrow issue. But as soon as you have wider, more long-standing issues that come into play, such as electoral fraud, other aspects of government corruption, repression of freedom of speech, state brutality towards citizens, that is where what can be a fairly singular demonstration suddenly becomes a nationwide issue, as we've seen, particularly with demonstrations occurring in traditional Sandinista strongholds of Leon and Esteli, shows that now that we can't. I think that is why the US State Department taking that decision, it is just to mitigate that aspect of unpredictability.
Right. So again, for companies in Nicaragua in the longer term, and organizations working there, I mean, what are the things they should now be thinking about if they look ahead, and especially security leadership's trying to think about its policies and, you know, how to deal with this? And obviously, I get the impression it really isn't on the scale of Honduras, which obviously caused, you know, significant concern, especially amongst US companies operating there. You know, should we think about with Nicaragua?
I think the main takeaway for companies operating in the area is to make sure they don't have that direct association with Ortega's government. They don't want to be seen as being on side or currying favor with them or issuing any kind of special treatment to Sandinistas.
Right.
I think companies, if we see a resumption of protests where it's ultimately driven by that anti-government sentiment, companies that do have that association, they're going to be obvious targets for Nicaraguans to direct that anti-government sentiment. As you said, we've seen that in Honduras, where any kind of association with US companies, they were an easy target for demonstrators. Embassy buildings, consulates, they had heavy security. So it was hotel chains, banks, those were the ones where they were a more immediate target. So I think that's something that for companies operating in Nicaragua, that's the key takeaway.
And I guess there's probably some level of local factor there as well. I mean, I know companies in Venezuela that were sort of managed to be in with everyone and so weren't particularly picked on because, you know, they were seen as inoffensive, even though they could have been implicitly exposed. And I think that's probably Latin America as a whole, that, you know, if you need to keep in enough with the right people, I guess, so as not to be completely isolated. But as you say, I mean,
without angering everybody else.
If you get too close into one camp, and it did raise a question for me immediately when you said that, Amp, which is actually, you know, but how do you operate in these countries without being somewhat friendly with the government, especially in a, shall we say, a somewhat corrupt environment? I'm not actually, of course, saying anyone's involved in corruption. Especially on the corporate side, and, you know, I try to think they were, but this is inherently, you know, a corrupt environment.
It's a concern across the region. I think, especially for major companies operating there, they have to be to a degree on side with ruling government.
Yeah.
But it's treading that line between being on side, but without being seen to be directly, or without being directly involved with allegations of high level corruption that afflicts so many of the governments in the region.
So I think, yeah, it probably re-emphasizes that global trend and obviously the ethical imperative that I'm sure any listeners would share, which is obviously to avoid corruption anyway. But I think it reinforces that because certainly companies that were, you know, could be accused of corruption and getting contracts, you know, would now find themselves doubly exposed. And I think the environmental movement in particular you mentioned is there, and something we might perhaps see foreign companies, as it were, and particularly those other sort of global interests that we talked about going into the country, may be more exposed to, I guess, because I think potentially less concerned about perceptions of corruption if they're getting the geopolitical results they want. I think, therefore, potentially more exposed in these sorts of situations.
Yeah, I mean, quite right. It's companies needing to mitigate the exposure to reputational risk when operating in these countries. What provokes response from the wider international community and is a source of a lot of criticism is, you know, companies infringing on indigenous rights and on indigenous land.
Yeah.
That is particularly amongst a younger demographic is what we're seeing. That is what takes people out of the houses and onto the streets to really voice their concerns over issues such as corruption and abuse of human rights.
Brilliant. Antonio, I think we covered that really well. Thank you very much for joining
us
today.
Justin.
And I think to kind of sum up with that, really, you know, Nicaragua, the problem being kicked slightly down the road, protests, you know, likely to continue, even though they might die down now. And again, a scenario I think we might see elsewhere in the world this year and echoing a number of wider trends, both globally and especially in your region. So I know that'll keep you particularly busy, Ant. So thanks again for joining us.
That's a pleasure, Justin.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you have found this podcast useful. If you would like to learn more about our services, or if you have any questions or feedback, please get in touch at info@sibylline.co.uk.